Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm here today with Andrew Sandoval Strauss. He is Associate Professor of History at Penn State University, as well as the Director of the Latina Studies Program there. He is the author of Hotel, An American History, that was published by Yale University Press in 2007, and a co-editor with Nancy Kwok of Making Cities Global, The Transnational Turn in Urban History, that was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2018. And we're here today to talk about his great 2019 book, Barrio America, How Latino Immigrants Saved the American City, and it was published by Basic Books. Andrew, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Eric.
Yeah, would you start by talking about your book a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Essentially, Barrio America's basic thesis is contained right there in the subtitle, right? How Latino immigrants saved the American city. I try to take the reader back to a period anywhere from 50 to 30 years ago when American cities were in just terrible shape, right? They were losing population, they were losing businesses, they were facing fiscal crises, and there was rapidly rising crime. And there's just a period of a few decades where many people, from just everyday urban residents to lots of urbanists themselves, who said, you know, it may be that the era of the big American city has simply come and gone. And from now on, production and distribution and retail is just going to move out to the periphery, and cities are going to be largely abandoned. And indeed, since this was the age of white flight, there was good reason to believe that the city had a pretty bleak future. But then things began pretty unmistakably to turn around, perceptibly beginning in about the mid-1990s. And since then, actually, the past 30 or so years, cities have been, for the most part, growing. I don't want to pretend that the Detroit and Baltimore and Gary, Indiana don't exist, but the vast majority of American cities have actually been gaining population and economic activity since then. And I wanted to really point out what I thought was the single biggest factor, at least populationally, in the recovery of American cities. Because, of course, so much attention had been given to that sort of creative class. Oh, it was, you know, rich, mostly white people that did all this good, important work in bringing back the city. Now, I want to say, well, actually, before any of those folks came back, really decades before, you began to see first in barrios and then sort of in the expansion of existing barrios, a situation where the influx of a total of about 25 million people who had been born in Latin America or who were the kids of people born in Latin America had moved just to American cities between about 1970 and about 2010 or 2015. And I think it's just inconceivable to imagine how many cities could have survived without this influx of people and all of the work they did for the businesses there and nearby, all the stores they opened, right, all of the schools and churches that they refilled. And it's just simply the case that a lot more of urban America would look like those sort of urban ruins books, you know, with pictures of abandoned factories and empty homes and shuttered schools in places, again, like especially Detroit. A lot more of America would look like that were it not for the influx of these, and I should say of other immigrants from elsewhere in the world. It's just because I speak Spanish that I did, you know, this take. But I think this book could be written by people who spoke Cantonese and Mandarin, Arabic, Hindi, Yoruba, and many other languages as well.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, you know, so kind of take us through the story of what happens. You know, you start seeing widespread migration, and then, you know, it's something that I think that in the media doesn't get a lot of attention until the 2000s in many ways. And it's kind of, you know, we're Americans think of race in this white-black narrative, and all of a sudden Latino population is getting near and then surpassing the black population in America. And so, you know, I feel like part of what your book is doing is sort of is inserting this narrative that's necessary to say sort of, hey, these people also have a history in the U.S. And so can you kind of bring us through you know, that story of how they arrive in one of the cities that you look at and how they begin to build those neighborhoods up?
Sure. I mean, the book is based primarily upon two neighborhoods, one in Chicago, one in Dallas. It's the Little Village or La Villita area on the west side of Chicago, and then in Oak Cliff on the sort of south of the Trinity River section of Dallas. And the chronologies differed a little bit, but generally speaking, what you see is that these neighborhoods reach their peak populations around the sort of 1920 to 1950 period. And then they gradually begin to empty out. And there are a number of reasons for this. You know, one is essentially deindustrialization, that there are plenty of businesses that are moving their production elsewhere. And the other is racism, that these are previously all white neighborhoods that border and have very sharp borders with African-American neighborhoods. With the coming of the civil rights movement, more Black families would like to live in neighborhoods, you know, where they're not forced to, right? Where the unit cost of a square foot of space is lower, where the schools are quote unquote better. And so with this initial migration of a small number of Black families, local white people, you know, some of them resort to violence, many more of them simply move out to the suburbs. So overall, in urban America, you see a continuous drop in the population of most cities from 1950 to 1980. And then the beginnings of a reversal after about 1980. So essentially the pattern here is that white people are leaving. After about 1970, right, you begin to see the influx of largely Mexican, but also Salvadoran, Guatemalan, and Salvadoran and other Nicaraguan and other Central Americans who begin to sort of effectively backfill these emptying out neighborhoods because they're looking for affordable housing, right? They are, the vast majority are low wage workers. So what they, you know, what they take in, they don't want to spend on rent. So a neighborhood that is gradually being, you know, abandoned is one where people really want to rent out or in many cases sell their houses. So this is sort of a natural magnet for those who, again, are seeking inexpensive housing. Now, this is sort of, again, a gradual process, but I think the other major factor that I want to overlay upon this is that one of the big sort of motors of urban prosperity from the 19-teens up to about the late 1960s is that lots of African-American workers were moving in, and that sort of helped take America to that 1950 peak. But remember, after about 1970, you know, white flight has been ongoing for more than 20 years. Some Black families now are moving out of the cities. Some of them are going to the suburbs because of the sort of passage of laws outlawing discrimination in lending. They're not, you know, universally effective, but they do allow opportunities for some better off African American families. And then after that, in starting about the 1990s, there are a lot of well-to-do Black people that actually moved back to the urban South, precisely to places like Dallas and Atlanta, which have the, you know, the most prosperous Black populations in the region. So essentially, the initial white outflux, then followed by a certain amount of Black departures, leaves even more sort of available housing for these newcomers. And I think one of the things I really want to emphasize is that there's a narrative that some people say, like, oh, well, you know, these Hispanic immigrants pushed Black people out of the neighborhoods. That didn't happen because in almost, certainly in both of the cases I was looking at, these Latinos move into previously all white neighborhoods that are at the same time gaining a few more, you know, Black residents, but the traditionally African-American areas of deindustrializing or of shrinking cities, those are not the places that any kind of immigrants move for reasons we can talk about by the by. But again, that sort of various, that process is sort of a succession of old white ethnic immigrant stock people by newer immigrant stock people, except they're mostly, again, from Latin America and Asia. And I think, you know, I'll cut this answer short just a little bit, but I think one of the other key things is that they begin to offer a lot of very available labor in areas where the rising sectors of cities really, really need them, right? So a lot of these, you know, Latinos are employed in home construction. A lot of them are employed in housekeeping. A lot of them are employed in childcare. A lot of them are employed in building maintenance, and a lot of them are employed in sort of essentially restaurant and other kinds of hospitality services, right? And those are exactly the kinds of areas that A, are growing, and B, are very much in demand, so that when the yuppies, you know, the creative class eventually do show up, that's exactly the kinds of amenities that they're looking for, right? Restaurants, nice office buildings, and renovated homes.
And which then also explains why they're not so much going to Detroit, Baltimore, and going to Dallas and Chicago, right? So, that's super interesting. And another thing I thought was really fascinating about the book is, you know, I know you're a scholar of sort of public space and the ways in which cities are built, and you know, the kind of transnational side of your book gets into the urbanization of Latin America and how that will then impact the United States. So, can you talk a little bit about the development of cities in Latin America at the same time that cities are sort of being de-emphasized in the U.S. and the ways in which people use public space in Latin America?
All right. Absolutely. Right. I think there are two stories here. The first one is about really huge macro level population changes. And the other is about the kind of micro geography of how people use things like the sidewalk and their front yards. So the macro story is essentially that, you know, the historiography of urban America has, of course, been a story mostly of suburbanization, right? Everything from Ken Jackson's classic Crabgrass Frontier, which is about how the big trend is that cities are shrinking and suburbs are growing. And that's absolutely true throughout Anglo-America. However, in the entire rest of the world, including Latin America, the opposite is true after 1950. You see just stupendous urban growth in Latin America, Africa, Middle East, Asia. So what I try to suggest in the book is that the sort of Latino-led re-urbanization of America is in a sense an after-effect of an existing urbanization of Latin America. So lots of these migrantes actually have moved already from the rural areas where they were born and lived in their early lives. They've often moved to places like Mexico City or Monterrey, and then sort of, in other words, they've already urbanized, and then they continue to urbanize to an American city. So I suggest that, you know, earlier on, I mentioned that I thought there were about 25 million new Latinos in U.S. cities from about 1970 to 2010 or 2015. Over roughly the same period, there are about 250 million new urbanites in Latin America, right? So this sort of big, huge transformation of urbanization begins there and then sort of spills over into the U.S. I might also add that, you know, Ken Jackson and other scholars made famous the fact that essentially the U.S. government, through mortgage programs, through tax allowances for construction of new commercial properties, effectively subsidized suburbanization to the tune of billions and billions of dollars in this period. In those same years, Latin American governments, virtually everybody, especially in Mexico, but also in other major sending countries like, or places like Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, you see precisely the opposite. They're concentrating all their spending in and around cities because what they're trying to do is create their own industrial base so they're no longer dependent upon other countries. So the part one of that is to say the macro trends originate in Latin America and then come to incorporate the United States. The other thing is the micro trends, and that's the way that people from Latin America are used to using public space. And I think the single most important factor is that rates of car ownership, of course, in the United States are soaring every time, you know, every decade after that, you know, famous car builder and anti-Semite Henry Ford, you know, creates the Model T, makes a car available to the masses. So the rate of car ownership, on the other hand, in Latin America is much, much lower, right? So for example, in 1960, in Mexico, the Latin American country probably with the most cars, the rate of car ownership is only 1/18th the rate in the United States. So these are people who are used to walking around a lot more. And remember that one of the big reasons for the abandonment of the city center is the advent of the automobile and, you know, the desire of an increasingly automotively oriented people to want to, you know, drive to the store, put all of their, you know, shopping in the trunk of the car and then drive home, that leads to the rise of suburban malls. But these 25 million new urbanites are used to hanging around the plaza, right? Remember that Latin American cities are typically deliberately, you know, very centered upon a central place called the plaza or the Zócalo. And so their tendency to walk places rather than drive. And here I have, you know, lots of descriptions in the book from both Anglo-Americans saying, hey, these folks are, you know, they'll walk down the street, they walk right by our store, and then they come in and buy something, and then they walk down to the barbecue place and have some barbecue there. It really rescued us. So the fact that city centers built before the full advent of the automobile are emptying out, the people who are coming to replace those leaving are perfectly suited to a pre-automobile landscape because they're from a pre-automobile landscape. So they patronize local stores. They, you know, put their businesses in some of these very small, you know, 15 or 25 foot wide storefronts that no Anglo-American merchant wants to touch because the new model of retailing is, you know, you want 100,000 square feet surrounded by, you know, 5 acres of parking at least. I think the other thing is the fact of a public culture among Latin American migrants, right? A lot of them are very used to just socializing in the streets and in front of their house, right? If you think of many books, starting with The Fall of Public Man and continuing through to The Lost City and Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, the basic idea of which is we've lost our public culture and everyone's doing everything, you know, at home. Instead of going to the movie theater or the movie palace, they've got their private home theater. Instead of going to the big public swimming pool, they swim in their backyards, right? That's true for Anglo-America, but for Latino America, these are people who are very used to socializing in their front yards. So I have a lot of photographs in the book of, you know, this phenomenon called in Spanish, la yarda, right? It's sort of a Spanglish term. And la yarda is the your front yard when you put fencing around the front of it, and then you put like the kids' play sets in the front yard so that they can play safely inside the fencing, you know, the you know, mom and dad or abuela and abuelo can keep an eye on the kids. And then everyone comes and sort of socializes over that front fence. That brings a lot of street life and a lot of eyes on the street, as Jane Jacobs would have said, to the urban cityscape.
And, you know, and to me, this was fascinating because the story itself, but also what it leads to, right? And the ways in which your book pushes back on narratives around, you know, Latin American cities or Latin American immigrants and crime, about public health and the city, and the kind of unknown cultural benefits or even health benefits from the ways in which these immigrants are reshaping these American cities. Could you talk a little bit about these issues?
Well, I mean, I think that the most obviously presently relevant one is the issue of crime, right? In our political moment of the last 4 years, you know, if there's one thing that Donald Trump has come back to over and over and over, it's how, you know, how dangerous cities are and how these illegal immigrants are coming in and, you know, killing good, wholesome, honest Americans. And the truth of the matter is exactly 180 degrees in the opposite direction, right? So to begin with, overall, cities, like the rest of America, but cities especially, have been getting much, much safer. The peak of urban crime was reached in the 1980s, and since then it has fallen dramatically. So that, for example, in New York City, crime is down by about 88% from 1991 to about 2016. In Los Angeles, it's down about 75%. There's just an extraordinary drop in the number of people getting assaulted, and especially the number of people getting killed, of a kind that, you know, this was the most dramatic symptom of the urban crisis for a lot of people. You know, whether you're white or black, just the fact that in New York City in 1991, there's 6 homicides per day. It's just an extraordinary rate. And you know, that's down now to about 1. At the same time, right, as the city has continued to grow. There are many different reasons why that happened. And honestly, criminologists just figured out, you know, they sort of finalized the idea that, like, yeah, there's been a dramatic crime decline. They had that figured out by the early 2000s. And now what they're working on is exactly why did that happen. So that's sort of still in process. But one of the reasons, quite unmistakably, is that foreign-born people commit far fewer crimes per capita than American-born people, right? And I should say this is true of all foreign-born people. This is true of all immigrants. But you can actually go through every single individual nationality and say, yep, that's true for Salvadorans. You know, one-third the likelihood of being involved in a crime for young Salvadoran men. Same thing is true for Guatemalans. Same thing is true for Mexicans. So for statistically speaking, for every one of these folks that crosses the border and comes to live in the United States in cities, right, whether documented or undocumented, makes Americans on average safer. Now, what's been remarkable is that it's increasingly possible to map this. So you can show that not only is it true that in neighborhoods with a lot of immigrants that you see a lot less crime, but in every census tract that borders those neighborhoods, whether or not there are a lot of immigrants in them, they tend also to have lower crime. I think the connection between the two is, you know, what I mentioned about all of these Latinos very much being in their front yards, you know, having, you know, a lot of thriving businesses along the main streets, you know, playing domino on the sidewalk, is that that creates a situation where a lot of people are keeping a close eye on the public realm. So if you look at Jane Jacobs' 1961 classic, you know, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and she describes, you know, why is Greenwich Village so safe? She says, their eyes upon the street. People are watching out for it. So when I go back and do, close statistical analysis based on the uniform crime surveys from the FBI, you find that both of the neighborhoods I look at, Oak Cliff and Little Village, have substantially lower crime rates than they would if their residents had been American born.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. And you know, I guess the where this sort of leads to, right, is that you have these revitalized cities, and you know, white people start moving back in, as you point out, and then. You know, then we start seeing, and what we are seeing in many places, right, is gentrification. And, you know, you have a scenario where, you know, white people may want to move into this neighborhood because they can have, you know, tacos and pupusas, just down the street. And that's great. But then, you know, they start creating a scenario where the taco and pupusas are still there, but the people are having to, you know, travel into to actually, you know, work in their shops. And I guess I'm wondering what your take is on the present and near future of the you know, Latino city.
It's a really interesting question. And as a historian, you know, I love to speculate about the future.
We all do. Yes, I know.
I mean, generally speaking, one of the lesser known facts is that the really big, at least Mexican migration across the Rio Grande stopped in about let me take that back. The net migration across the Rio Grande was more southbound than northbound as of about 15 years ago, right? So the sort of big population changes based on specifically Mexican migration are over and have in small ways begun to reverse themselves. There's certainly a Central American migration that's happening, but of course, Central American countries are a tiny fraction the size. So broadly speaking, I think you'll see, depending on sort of what the political scene and the economic situation look like, you'll see an ongoing but much, much smaller migration from Latin America, a much greater migration from Asia, but that's going to be somebody else's specialty. So I think these neighborhoods may continue to sort of grow as a matter of immigration. But another big trend is that these are pretty transient neighborhoods. So even, you know, the Salvadoreños and the Mexicanos and the Guatemaltecos who move in, a lot of them pretty quickly move out to a nearby suburb in search of better schools pretty quickly. So I don't mean to suggest that all of these Latinos move in and then they stay there. They don't. There's sort of a dynamic process. So I think you're going to see a certain amount of migration out to nearby, either suburban areas or nearby smaller metropolitan areas. So for example, you've seen over the past few years, a net migration out of places like New York and into places like Allentown and Reading. So a lot of these smaller industrial cities will pick up a secondary migration that is the result of rising land costs often driven by gentrification. So I think cities will probably continue to be prosperous, might look fairly stable in terms of their Latino population, because for every you know, fulano or fulana moving in, there's probably another one trying to find a better schools or more affordable housing for their families.
Yeah. So we are having this interview on October 29th, and we're 5 days away from the 2020 election. And I think it's, you know, since you're here, you know, I think it's worth talking a little bit about the Latino vote, Latinos in American politics, the way that Donald Trump has demonized this section of the population in such a horrible way. And so, you know, I don't, you know, this is not really a question as much as it is just an opening. Like, what thoughts do you have about the state of Latino politics in 2020 and you know, vis-a-vis the rest of the country, and what you think might happen on Tuesday?
Sure. I mean, 2016 was, of course, an extraordinary disappointment as a Latino and as an American, because there was this opportunity there for the nation and specifically Latino voters to effectively say, don't pick on us, don't ever do that again, or we'll drive you from, you know, any office that you hold. And that's what a lot of writers, both in Spanish and in English, expected to happen, right? The Latino sleeping giant would finally fully awaken and drive the xenophobes out of their perches in Washington. And essentially what you had is you had a slight improvement in the sort of percentage vote over 2012, so the margins for Clinton were quite large, but there was no overall increase in the proportion or really the number of Latino voters. I mean, everyone expected, oh, more people are signing up, more people are registering, they're going to get out there and vote, and that clearly didn't happen. So you know, that was in the broad arc of American and of Latino history, that was a real missed opportunity to get people to stop picking on us and demonizing us, because, you know, had it happened the way most people expected, you know, the biggest minority in America would, I think, have been just politically untouchable, except maybe regionally. Now what we find unexpectedly is that, at least according to initial polling, Donald Trump is not doing any worse among Latinos than he did in 2016, and he might be doing a little bit better, which is alarming and surprising. And as it turns out, right, in an election structured in so many ways about race, his biggest losses are among upscale whites. So like the horror of children being torn away from their parents and stuck in cages, that doesn't seem, maybe it'll turn out differently when we see the exit polls in a few days, but that doesn't seem to have changed a lot of Latinos' minds. It does seem to have changed a lot of white suburbanites' minds and said, like, this is simply too wrong. I can't abide this. So while the election is certainly rhetorically about racial dynamics, and certainly, you know, one of the best predictors of how somebody will vote is their ethno-racial identity. At the same time, there's also the factor that if you think this is just going to be purely a question of the respective proportions of what race of people are voting where and how, no, you really have to look at education levels. That's going to be your big marker. And that's amazing.
I mean, why do you think that is? I think a lot of us are sort of, you know, and are sort of befuddled by this. And, you know, I've spent enough time in Latin America that I think I have some answers to this. But, you know, you're much more of an expert than I. So why is, you know, Republicans' support among the Latino community, why does it not look like the Black support for Republicans in that community, which is tiny? What's at the root of this, do you think?
I mean, well, I think we should begin by remembering that Barack Obama in his second run for office and Hillary Clinton in her run for office in 2016 actually did somewhat better than the average Democrat among Latinos, right? The average Hispanic vote for Republican candidates has been about 30%, right? Maybe sometimes a little bit higher. It was said that George W. Bush in 2004, he may have gone as high as 40%. And of course, you know, I won't spend too much time on this. That was Karl Rove's big plan for ruining the Democratic Party, is to capture a greater proportion of Latinos. So in one sense, it's just a reversion to the mean, right? That there are a certain amount of Latinos who, for cultural reasons involving religion or political reasons involving where they came from, can be quite conservative, right? Sort of in your mind, you think of, you know, all of those Central American civil wars that the United States made far, far worse or effectively fomented. And you think of the refugees as, oh, this is the sort of, you know, the peasants and the left fleeing the area, fleeing the region. Yeah, it was also sometimes, you know, the genocidaire fleeing the region too. So, you know, some of those death squad members end up in Los Angeles. And if you look at, you know, that amazing novel, The Tattooed Soldier, that's exactly about that kind of an encounter. So the transnational politics of it look very different. But, and I should say that there's a fantastic new book by Jerry Cadava called The Hispanic Republican that deals with that. And I absolutely take his point that, you know, close to or about a third of Latinos were just hardcore Republicans before. But nonetheless, I'm still shocked, amazed, and confused by how we couldn't be at least, you know, 80-20. Maybe we will be, but I think it's going to take years or decades to work out exactly what happened with Latino voting. And especially after, you know, in 2019, the biggest massacre of Latinos in the history of the country, that happens the year after the biggest massacre of Jews in the history of the country, you know, not exactly because they were Jews, but because they were helping immigrants. You sort of look at those kinds of civil violence and think, how can you not get what's going on here? But again, telling people how they should vote is often kind of a loser's game.
Yeah, that is for sure. So one last question, I guess, and that has to do with anti-immigrant sentiment in this country. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering what, you know, your take is on the, as Latinos become a larger proportion of the United States and are spreading into more and more places, like you talk about Allentown and Reading and cities like that, that are still fairly new, not to mention, you know, your Iowas and your Kansases and your Arkansas and places like this. Do you see, like how do you see the anti-immigrant politics of America shifting over time? Or, you know, another way of asking this, I guess, is, you know, a lot of people have speculated that some Latinos begin to be identified as white, and you have that, you know, the constantly shape-shifting whiteness that allows the integration of some of these, at least lighter-skinned Latinos into, you know, white America. And so I guess I'm just, you know, from a historian's perspective, but also from somebody, you know, who has analyzed these issues in such depth, I'm wondering what you think about the near future of Latino population in America and anti-immigrant sentiment.
Sure. I mean, I think there are two major factors here. One is geography, and here is sort of the anti-factor, I would say, is labor. So let's begin with geography and just say that right after 2016, a lot of people misinterpreted exactly what it was that had happened. And they said, oh, it's these, you know, these people from deindustrializing areas that have seen their livelihoods dry up, and, you know, with the outsourcing of their work, you know, there are plenty of people under pressure from immigrant labor competition, et cetera, and that's why they voted the way they did. And that sounded pretty intuitive because, I mean, to be honest, a lot of those mostly white people in places like small cities like Reading and Allentown, they had gotten jammed and they had reason to be angry. But then when political scientists looked at it geographically, they said, you know, what predicted a big surge of voting for Trump was mostly if people lived in mostly white communities with very, very few or no immigrants, those were the folks that were most kind of motivated to vote for him. It was actually not the people most directly in labor competition with immigrants. It was those most isolated and insulated from those sort of theoretical kinds of competition. So to begin with, it was sort of very much an urban and inner suburban who tended to be more pro-immigrant versus a rural who tended to be more anti-immigrant. You know, the short phrase I use at rallies is, you know, Americans who know immigrants love immigrants, because the strongest support for whether it be in the form of more permissive immigration laws or general legalizations or amnesties, that comes from the cities. The other thing that I think we need to really look carefully at is the effort by certain kinds of right wingers to pose as kind of friends of labor, friends of the working man, by sort of spouting a few anti-corporate slogans, which, you know, it's worth saying stuff like that, but then turning and saying, okay, these corporations, what they've done is the great evil of inviting these immigrants in. They invited them in to ruin you, and, you know, they're the ones pushing down your wages. And again, this is, you know, from Tucker Carlson to a whole bunch of his little clones in the commentariat and in politics, is just an effort to capitalize on white resentment while seeming to be making a labor argument. But the argument is not about, hey, what can we do to make the conditions of working people better? But, you know, what can we do to channel your hostility against immigrants? Now, I think where you can really see this is, what is their solution? Because, of course, if somebody were really, really concerned about undocumented people providing unfair labor competition to the native born because they'll accept, you know, lower wages, then the obvious answer is, well, you need a mass regularization of exactly the kind that John McCain and Ted Kennedy proposed in 2005. But conspicuously, those people who are, you know, the pretend friends of the working man never say, ah, if we allow these 11 million people to bargain for higher wages because they have, you know, security of residence, that will push up everybody's wages. They keep not saying that, conspicuously so, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, and, you know, it's a cynical effort, I think, to split workers off from each other, which, let's face it, has worked in American history, you know, all too often. So, you know, I would like to hope that people are increasingly resistant to this, particularly given the, you know, utter cynicism. But I guess we'll see. Anyway, I want to thank Andrew Sandoval-Strauss for speaking with us today. And I really want to encourage all of our listeners to buy his wonderful 2019 book, Barrio America, How Latino Immigrants Saved the American City. Thanks again, Andrew.
Thanks, Eric. This was so much fun.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,